This is The Big Web Show, featuring special guests and topics about web publishing, art direction, content strategy, typography, web technology, and more. It's everything web that matters. The show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and by Dan Benjamin. That's me. And this is a special episode number 41. It's a special episode. Jeffrey Zeldman is on his way, or perhaps already at, South by Southwest, being that this is South by Southwest week here in March 2011. And we thought that rather than leave you guys with nothing, we would create a very special episode that's really going to feature the best moments of the Big Web Show. And that is what this is. We'd like to say thanks to FreshBooks.com, online invoicing, and Rackspace.com for making this episode possible. Really hope you like it. And please, of course, let us know. You can do that by going to 5by5.tv/contact. Tell us what you think. Check out all the other shows that we've been producing. There's some new ones out there. Anyway, thanks for listening. And here is the show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Metzendorf, senior audio engineer for 5by5. I wanted to take a quick second to introduce each of the segments in this edition of the show. I don't think it does justice to the quality of the guests that Dan and Jeffrey have to call this a best of program, so let's think of it as just a little bit of the best of the Big Web Show. I encourage you all to check out past episodes of the program at 5by5.tv. Now, here's an excerpt from episode 16 with Sonny Brown, where they talk about the value of doodling.
Now, when you're also, I mean, you're in, you work in client services, so help me understand, is this, yeah. Are you like Adaptive Path plus doodles? I mean, do you come in to solve?
I love them. I think they're awesome.
I know I love them too. But so you come in to solve client problems and you go, okay, let's all get our pens out and figure this out.
Right. So, okay. So if you want to know how I got started, it was because I was basically doing that. I was taking content that was streaming from a group conversation or from a presentation, and I was visualizing it for those participants, whoever they were. Sometimes it would be like people doing strategic planning for a big enterprise, or it would be people trying to solve some kind of problem in their system, like if it was a factory or whatever. And so, and what I discovered and what a lot of other practitioners discover is that when you show people what they're talking about, then they understand better, you know? So you can write, they could have typed up a 10-page Word document about what the problem was in the factory, but you could also draw a picture of the system and then everybody goes, oh my God, this is what's happening, you know? And that's true for all people that I've worked with. And that's why I started thinking, what's going on here? You know, I don't understand why there's such an aversion to it when it's such a naturally useful thing, you know?
It helps you understand. It also helps you remember, doesn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
When I was in college, if I took visual notes of what I was reading and wrote out little charts and stuff with like you're reading a Russian novel with 5,000 characters and you write all their names and show like which cousins married which cousins and all that stuff, then you actually remember it when you have to take the test because you have a visual memory of, as opposed to trying to remember an abstract story, a story that you haven't seen a movie of, where you don't know what the characters look like.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually a phenomenon. It's called the picture superiority effect. And it was studied by a guy named Paigio, or I forget, he's an Italian guy, but I used to know his name and I will shortly. But anyway, long story short, that the impact of imagery on our cortex is, we have about a 90% retention rate of images that we were shown up to like a year later, and then 10 years later it's like still at 60% or something. But if you show somebody a series of words and ask them to remember or if you even have a professor, for example, or a teacher talking to people, and then 72 hours after they leave that learning environment and you ask them what they retain, it's like 10%. I mean, it's crazy. It's distinctly different. But I'm curious about you being a visual note taker. Were you like that your whole life, or you were taught that, or how did you do that? You just did it naturally?
Wow, I'd have to remember college. I think it came naturally. I don't think anyone turned me on to it. My dad's an engineer, but he was kind of an amateur artist, right? He was like the president of the Connecticut Classic Arts Club, and he made sculptures in our basement and stuff. So we used to play this game called the Wiggly Line game, which my daughter plays now, where one person draws a line and the other some random squiggle and the other person has to make an image out of it. So I guess, I wanted to make comic books professionally, like when I was like 8. I was like really serious about it, you know. I really wanted to create the next Spider-Man or something. And and I think, you know, and I didn't, I mean, it was a big deal to buy like a manual typewriter or something. We didn't really have, you know, we churned our own butter and made our own socks, and we didn't, I didn't grow up with computers, right? They came as I was an adult, right? Uh-huh. Like a young adult, a very young adult, I should say. But so if you didn't grow up with devices that could do things for you, it was sort of natural to just all the time be taking notes anyway. And since I like to draw and my mind wanders, I would just start doodling, and then it, you know, it sort of merged the two.
But, you know, I think there's something that happens when you're a little kid, and maybe it's different for girls, I don't know, but I remember as a little boy and my friends too, we were always drawing stuff. And at some point, whether it's your teachers or whoever, they're like, okay, stop drawing. You know, don't draw in class. And eventually this skill that maybe everybody has the potential to develop, you just kind of push it to the side, and you don't really, typically you don't do that anymore. So you stop drawing, you're discouraged from drawing. And I remember I even had teachers that would they'd take points off if you had drawings on your notes, and they would look at your notes and things like that. I mean, why do we sort of reject this, Sonny? Why do we go in that direction?
It's such an infinite question. And, you know, I don't know, I tend to be philosophical, so I think there's so many ways to answer that. But one of the ways that I think is notable and is sort of part of my doodle revolution is that, people misinterpret the doodler. So when someone's talking, right, and there's so many fun episodes, like when at the World Economic Forum and somebody will be doodling and people will be like, oh my God, he's not taking it seriously, right? And so I think that people just actually underestimate and misunderstand what's happening when someone's doodling. They usually think that if they're talking and someone's drawing, they generally think that they've checked out completely,
right,
that they're,
right,
you know, that they're too smart for the material and they're, you know, bored out of their mind. So the posture, I think the very posture of somebody doodling is off-putting to the person speaking. And I think, you know, in classrooms, for example, that's probably one of the biggest things. It's, they're like, Billy, you know, focus.
Right, exactly.
You know, and so it's like, I don't want to, you know, harass teachers, but anyway, go ahead.
I was just going to say, even when you're doodling, if you're not drawing what the teacher's talking about, you're multitasking. Basically, you're just, if someone was doing yoga while listening to you,
right,
you wouldn't say, pay attention, stop sitting cross-legged, this is serious.
Right.
So, yeah, there's this sense that you can't use multiple parts of your brain at the same time, or that if you're being visual just as a kind of emotional relief or a way of exercising, it's like you're exercising mm-hmm. while you're listening. You're giving yourself some visual pleasure while you're listening, and that's uh-huh. frowned upon.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can elaborate on that.
Okay, I want you to elaborate.
The other thing that I've noticed, there's like so many trains of thought. So one of the things I noticed too is that people, like I said, they think that you're not paying attention, but there was a really interesting study that came out of the University of Plymouth in the UK. And what she did is she tested the retention rates of people who were doodling versus people who were, you know, like model students, people who were like looking like they were paying attention and taking notes, but they weren't, you know, drawing or anything. And she tested their retention afterward, and the doodlers had a 30% higher retention rate of really boring content, which was part of their study, you know, because if it's like kind of riveting.
They were drawing notes, or they were just drawing?
They were just drawing. They were actually only, they were scribbling in circles and squares. So they weren't even drawing images. They were only keeping their hand busy, which is why when you were talking about, you know, like exercising, it's a kinesthetic movement that for most people, like there's three types of learners. There's auditory, visual, and kinesthetic. And all of us are combinations of these things. But for people who are kinesthetic, which is a large majority of people, and visual, like as a combo, that doodling is an act of keeping your body awake And so, because it engages your kinesthetic and your visual channels. And so it actually is igniting your brain as opposed to you, you know, like being a goof off, you know, but it doesn't look that way. And so it has an unfortunate effect of teachers, you know, spanking your hand or whatever they used to do with like rulers, you know, like wrap your knuckles or whatever. Yeah.
That was Sunny Brown from episode 16 of The Big Web Show. Here's a little bit of episode 19 with Aaron Walter. Aaron is the lead user experience designer for MailChimp. In this episode, the gang talks about white hat SEO strategies, usability, and a whole lot more.
I guess let's start, because I'm sure a lot of people want to hear about this, SEO findability web standards.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
So I wrote this book a couple years ago, as you mentioned, Building Findable Websites, and people don't just find your website through search. There are lots of other ways that people discover content. I also felt like there's a pretty clear divide and quite a bit of animosity between the camps of the SEO folks out there and the standardistas, you guys. And just kind of the general web community. And basically what's happened is, people want to make money. You know, they've got businesses, they're trying to get their business out there. They've got a message. There are, you know, hundreds of millions of websites on the web at the moment, and being one in a couple hundred million is very difficult to get to your audience. So people, I have faith in humanity, but sometimes humanity goes down the wrong path and people just get super focused, hyper focused on getting to the top of those search rankings.
Right.
And they do some nefarious things to get there. In fact, BMW, the German BMW site in, I think it was like 2007, They did a bunch of black hat SEO stuff, and they got caught by Google and blacklisted. And I'm sure someone's head rolled for that in BMW. That's pretty huge for a major corporation like that to be blacklisted. And basically what happens is, they had to go groveling to Google, tell them how they would change it, why they would never do it in the future. It's kind of like, as someone that grew up Catholic, it kind of sounds like doing penance. You know, you have to do this penance and to get back in there. So at any rate, back to, why this book and the topic. And I feel like there's this divide between SEO folks and people building websites. But I feel like there's a right way to do this. And a lot of us that are building sites with standards, we've read your book, and you know, people are on board with that idea, and it's a big part of the way they conduct their business. And then they feel like, oh, I've got to go hire an expert, and that expert comes in and messes with markup and maybe does bad things. But we really don't. I kind of feel like we can do this ourselves. That we can just learn to build for humans first. And at the same time, make sure that our content is accessible to machines as well, which is going to help us reach more humans to make it more findable. So, using standards in your markup, clear information hierarchy with headings and strong emphasis, logical link text, logical title text, and not stuffing that with a bunch of junk like what we used to do in the late 90s with the meta element until Google came along and said, yeah, we're not going to look at that element. We're just going to look at the content in the page and index on that. And then, of course, people started gaming the system in the side of the content of the page. So that's kind of where I'm coming from on that. And I also like to think of things like micro formats as an important part of findability, because if you think about it in the physical world, when we lose objects and then we find it and we say, okay, I want to make sure I don't lose that again, like your keys. People lose their keys all the time. So what they do to solve that problem is they put their keys on a hook next to their door. So when they come in the house, they just put it on the hook so they know where to find it. This object is portable, and they put it in a location where they can rediscover it. And micro formats let us do that on the web. They make regular content just in regular old markup with some standardized pattern elements and classes and stuff around it. They make that content portable so I can move it to my address book so I can rediscover it. I can move it over to a calendar so I can set an alarm and not forget an event that I might have discovered on upcoming or you know, another website that's publishing a lot of micro format content. So that doesn't have anything to do with SEO necessarily, but it has everything to do with human behavior and the way that humans rediscover content. So
sure, it makes your content something that I don't go to the website to look at necessarily, but that I can pull from the website, that I can interact with, that becomes part of my life, my calendar.
Exactly.
Getting back to the SEO aspect of it just for a minute, you mentioned very quickly like five different things people could work on. And, you know, I mean, obviously your premise makes sense. If clients need this, and we're already designing and building their sites, it makes sense for us to know how to do this or how to do as much of it as possible. Then maybe they bring in an expert to work on something else, but essentially they have a very good, strong foundation in terms of findability. But if you could just take us through a couple of the things you mentioned a little bit more slowly. You said something about logical titles, and I don't know what that means. So what are you talking about there?
So the title element in the the head of the document, where we basically say this is the name of the website, or we put the name of the page.
Right.
That content is really important because that content shows up on a search results page, on Google search results page, as the title of the result there. So it's kind of, if we think about information hierarchy of our message, it's kind of top of the food chain. It really needs to communicate clearly, this is what my content is, this is the name of the website, and it might say briefly what it's about. So this is a tricky one. You want to kind of jam all of that stuff in there, but without being verbose and without being spammy, where you're putting in a million different words and so forth. This is where someone like Christina Halverson and a content strategist, or that thinking is really important about what words are we using to describe who we are. It's kind of, it's about branding, it's about business, and it's about content, and it's not about gaming. It's it's thinking about humans first, not about computers. But what I do is, a homepage, I'd have like the name of the site. Let's take, for example, a list apart. If I were writing the title text for a list apart, I would, for the homepage, I would, put in something like a list apart for people who make websites, because that describes what this is about. And at the same time, it's describing the publication, and it also is communicating, by saying people who make websites. The term website is kind of an important descriptor of the content and a way that people might discover that content as well.
Okay, and then on an article page, it wouldn't start with a list apart. You'd start with the title of the article or what the article is about, correct?
Yeah, title of the article. And then maybe it's followed by a list apart, so it's got the name of the publication.
So in your book, you have a whole bunch of standard white hat SEO techniques, right? Basically, and where those intersect with good HTML practices, you explain how that works. But it's not. But you are doing SEO too in the book. You're not just saying if you use semantic markup and make your most important headline in H1 and your second most, and your subtopic in H2, then everybody will find your content and you're done. You're not, it's not as simple as that. If it was that simple, you wouldn't need to have written your book. So it's sort of a combination of of white hat techniques and good semantic markup.
Yeah, and part of it, so the semantic markup stuff is important to communicate to computers. And then there's another part, which is, understanding what the human behavior is around your content. How do people look for this content? And there are lots of really nice tools out there. There's a website, ranks.nl, and there's a sub page within there. I don't remember what the URL is, but ranks.nl, where you can basically say, you know, this is how I would describe my website, or this is the content that I think that people would be putting into a search engine to try to find my website. And it will look at your website. You give it your URL and the keywords that you're evaluating against, and it'll say, this word shows up 27 times, or it shows up this percentage, it's got this prominence. And that can help you understand how your content is being viewed by a search engine. Now, it's not exactly like putting on the eyes of Google and looking exactly at your content, but it's a really nice way, you know, it gives you nice insight to see how you can adjust your content. And also, it's good if for people that have black hat tendencies, you can see when your content density, you know, like a keyword density gets a little bit too high. There's a 7% threshold. So words in the English language tend to not repeat themselves more than 7% of the time in a given body of text in a natural way. So, you know, anything below 7% is natural.
Yeah. Anyone who thinks that hasn't talked to my uncle, but okay.
So maybe he could use ranks.nl to rethink his message. But at any rate, so that's a tool that you can use to try to get a sense for how your message is being seen on search engines, how you can kind of massage that a bit more. It's, you know, it's honestly, it's a bit of alchemy to try to see how do I adjust my content? What's too much? What's not enough of describing your site? But again, you know, not to beat a dead horse here, you always keep in mind, is what I'm doing helping my audience or is it hurting my audience? I always like to frame the idea of findability in the context of user experience, because really what we're doing is helping people find what they want. It's not just about helping helping your bottom line.
We'd like to say thanks to FreshBooks.com for sponsoring today's episode. You know, I love running 5x5. I love making this stuff happen, but I'll tell you what I don't love. I don't enjoy spending time on the administrative stuff like invoicing. Well, enter FreshBooks. This is an easy-to-use online invoicing service that saves you time, it gets you paid faster, and it makes you look professional. And getting started is completely free. Just go to FreshBooks.com. You can sign up for a free account. And here's something that's very cool that they're doing just for you guys, just for 5x5 listeners. They're actually going to give away a birthday cake, an actual birthday cake to somebody that signs up from the show. All you need to do for a chance to win this is to enter in Big Web Show in the How Did You Hear About Us section when you sign up. Again, this is a free sign up. And I checked, it does not have to be your birthday to win. They will still get you a cake. So freshbooks.com, sign up for free, get your free cake, and enjoy invoicing all at the same time.
Here's an excerpt from episode 26 with entrepreneur Gary Vaynerchuk.
Do you recommend that they always have a person out front, like you or like Steve Jobs at Apple, or what about companies that are so, yeah, okay, go ahead.
I go the other way. I wish I was a product. I wish there could be 20 people doing my engaging for me right now, right? A human brand, a personal brand has a much more difficult time winning in this new world, in my opinion, at some level, in a certain way, that a brand does. I love the fact that we can put 45 people that are passionate about Campbell's soup behind the Campbell's logo and engage with people authentically. Lady Gaga and me and Chad Ochocinco and you and Dan Cederholm and, you know, Steve Jobs, it's much harder because when I hear that somebody tweets on behalf of somebody like you brought up earlier, there's a little upchuck going on in my stomach, you know?
Absolutely. I have the feeling Dan Benjamin wants to ask something.
I don't want to jump in here, but I will tell you something, Gary, and Jeffrey touched on this at the beginning of the show, and I just wanted to kind of go on the record. We talked about something like this a little bit earlier in our pipeline interview, but I think it's like even more now. Was reminded of this. You ever seen the movie Solitary Man with Michael Douglas in it? Okay, in this movie, long story short, he becomes this sort of baron of car sales, for long story short. But I mean, he was on the cover of Forbes and things like that. And later on, he loses his fortune, long story short, and winds up having to go to work for his college buddy, who's played by Danny DeVito. And Danny DeVito says that, you know, he's talking to Michael Douglas and he's saying, you know, man, when you were on the cover of Forbes, he's like, I felt like one of us had made it. And I think that's kind of what Jeffrey was saying. And I think there's something about you that it feels very much you're one of us, you know, like you came up through the same ranks. You were like just a guy for a while. And now you've kind of transcended being that just a guy and you've moved. And I think that's to me in the audience watching you, it felt like that kind of happened when you started showing up on like TV shows, real TV shows, not the TV shows that you were making yourself, which are, you know, how you kind of got to the bigger ones. And now you're doing radio. And before, so like, I really want to talk to you about your book, but before that, you know me, I love talk radio, and now you're like, you're doing it. So tell me about that. How did that happen?
Let me go back to a point and then I'll talk to you about Sirius, which by the way, airs tonight and has been moved because we've been so ridiculously successful from 10 to midnight to 8 to 10. So I'm pumped about that because West Coast for wine and tech is huge. And now I have the 5 to 7 slot.
Oh, so that's the drive time slot for them. That's huge.
Huge for me. But let me tell you something that you hit on. As you were saying that, like one of us made it and it feels good. It was funny what was going through my body, which is that the biggest thing that drives me to want to become ridiculously big, like the guy, and do television and win at television, the only thing that drives me for television is that I know that I will not change. The reason people feel good about me growing or making more happen is that because I don't change the way I am, it's still the engagement. And then it's like your buddy's winning. Like, you know, the person you most want to win is like your friend because you know he won't change on you. Like the graph gets smaller when you become Justin Timberlake or Lady Gaga, right? It just gets smaller. I have a employee at VaynerMedia who was really good friends with Matt Ryan, the quarterback of the Falcons, because he was a basketball player at BC. They were like solid friends. Now that Matt's like this big football star, he's not in that loop anymore. He doesn't have that cell number anymore. I think through things like Twitter and my inbox, people will always have access, and it makes it more fun for me. The biggest thing that drives me is somebody, I want to be Oprah or as big as I can be because I want everybody to be like, I can't believe that Gary Vaynerchuk now has 40 million people watching his television show. He never sleeps, but he still just at tweeted me and he still gives a crap and he remembers my girlfriend's name. The feeling I get when people are stunned that I didn't sell out is like a drug to me. I love that because I want to prove that it can be done. I want to rebrand celebrity at some level in our society. It is a secret thought in my mind. You know?
But at some point, though, doesn't that become impossible? I mean, doesn't it become impossible to reply to everybody?
Yes, I'm not doing it now. I mean, I'm not replying to everybody, but I'm replying to such an obscene amount that people know the effort is there. And I'm going to say it again. And people are not attaching to it, though I did see somebody retweet it. I wish everybody who watches this would retweet it because I want people to understand. Effort is underrated. Dan, it took 7 months for me to do Pipeline with you, right?
Right, yeah.
But we communicated the whole time.
Sure.
There was no radio silence. That was effort. Yeah, I could have let it sit in my inbox.
Very true.
Effort is underrated. Effort is underrated. Like the bottom line is, if you care and you try, if I'm answering 400 people a day, you can go to my Ustream feed and see it. And again, when Zelman's in a little cocktail party at a tweet up or at home with four or five buddies or working on a project and says something, people are like, no, I got an email from him 2 days ago. You did? You know, and it becomes this thing. I just think effort's underrated. And so when I have no time, I'll make time. So I'll do one, you know, if you end up doing five or six less things and you just engage, things will happen. And that's what I focus on. I do more things than ever. I sleep less than ever. I have a 17-month-old, so I spend more time with family than ever. I make time to watch every play of the New York Jets. And if my community and the people that helped grow me, because at the end of the day, it's a community thing, right? Like me tweeting out this show, I know that people are going to be like, oh man, 5x5, these guys are awesome. Let me start following this. Like you're going to have people watch every episode after this because of this engagement. On the flip side, there's a lot of people now getting a different look at me that didn't have this kind of view on me because of this. And it's just this community. And I just feel enormous gratitude and a tremendous, almost uncomfortable responsibility to win for our community and to give back to our community and to just be a good dude.
All right. All right. I hear all that and it's great. I want to ask you if you feel something that I often feel, which is guilt for friends who aren't doing as well, friends who aren't as successful. I have some, you know, friends or relatives who are really talented, work really hard, put in a lot of effort,
yeah.
But for whatever reason, it isn't working out for them. And does your success ever create sort of a gap between you and a friend?
No, and I'll tell you why. And I mean it. And maybe there is, and I don't see it, but I'm so psycho aware of this stuff, Zelman. You know why? Because the second my friend opens his mouth or her mouth or relative or anybody and says, you're so lucky you have this. You know what I mean, right, Zelman? When there's a comment or you could feel it in your gut, something weird's brewing about success. You know what I mean? I start painting a very clear picture of why they're winning too. When my friends are like, oh, Gary, you made it. Like, wow, what the hell? Like, I hate this job. I'm like, yeah, Keith, but you know, I don't know if you noticed, but you're home at 5 p.m. and you, Tom, Steve, and Johnny are going to the bar watching Monday Night Football. And you know your little 18-month-old at home, Sandy, that gorgeous little girl? You spend every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday with her. And so I have this unbelievable feeling outside of death and crazy, like, natural disasters and, you know, a couple of other things. But I don't know, you know, I feel life is massively fair in when it comes to business. And what I mean by that is I'm not just because I have stuff or acclaim or visibility or monetary success doesn't mean I'm a happier human being. Some of the probably the 8 most happy people I know are probably in the bottom 15% financially of people I know. I just think we need to look at it in a world view. I mean, we can look at it. I don't feel guilt because I have more dollars. I'm wondering if my friends feel more guilt because they have more time to play wiffle ball and in high school and college when I worked every freaking hour of my life and they were banging chicks at the Jersey Shore. Did they feel guilty for me? You know, and it's not a me against them. I'm thrilled. I mean, it's circumstance. You know, I mean, guess what? I wish I was born in America so I could run for office. I desperately love, you know, politics, but because I can't be president, I'm not going to do it. And you know what? I wish I was looking at AJ. I wish I was the third brother, not the first brother, because we were so un-Americanized. I didn't understand stuff and didn't live it up to a lot of potential. I mean, there's so many dynamics. It's just one little element of it. And I got to tell you, more money, more problems. You know, P. Diddy and Biggie, there's a lot of value to that. I'm not so sold. I'm not so much more happy today than I was 10 years ago because of finance. I'm more happy because I have a tremendous wife and I have an unbelievable little daughter. And all that money I think really does is give you freedom to do what you want. And it's been pretty much proven that that number is not so crazy. I don't know. I think, as you can tell, I think about this stuff quite a bit. The answer is no. And it's because they're winning in a lot of different ways than I am.
That was Gary Vaynerchuk from episode 26 of the show. Here's a little bit of Jason Santamaria's appearance on the Big Web Show from episode 30. Jason is the founder and principal of Mighty, a Brooklyn-based design studio. Among other things, he's also the creative director for A List Apart.
This is like I'm playing in the big leagues now. This is Jeffrey's bread and butter, but for me this was like nice, you know? And that's how I think
like that. Right. How do you call it like that now? But how you get there, anyone listening who wants to get there, how you get there is, you know, you start with your own little freelance you, and then you start collaborating with talented people. And if you can handle, you know, you scale up in budget and everything else. And if you can handle it and not blow it, right, not be terrified or not let the client know you're terrified, you work your way up to actually needing to become a company. But at that time, it wasn't like that. And so Doug stopped design, and he's now the lead designer at Twitter. Incredibly, he had been at Hotwired. He was the guy who brought Hotwired to Web Standard. So, right. So Doug's working on this project, and the client wanted to buy my design, which was a terrible design, and I wanted them to buy Doug's design, which was a great design, and they did. And then Doug threw his back out, and I was like, oh, my God, poor Doug. Also, what do I do now? Because I didn't feel that I was the right person to pick up Doug's design and run with it. So what happened then, Jason?
So I believe that Doug had done all of his files in Illustrator, and you weren't as up on Illustrator as you were Photoshop, and you were kind of wanting someone to just come in, make the edits and the revisions that the client had wanted silently. That way, you know, the project could just move forward really smoothly and everything would be okay. And I had just at the time written a post about how I started out a lot of my web design work in Illustrator at the time.
Gray box. Yeah, the gray box.
The gray box method, yeah. And you just dropped me a line kind of out of the blue. I think I emailed you maybe before, and I did what you've told me that a lot of people have done after they read your book, where they email you and they say, you know, I just redesigned, and then I apologized because my site wasn't using web standards at the time. I think that's what, yeah, what right. I did. And I know a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people do that where they, you know, they're redesigning their site and they're reading your book at the same time. And then by the time that they're done, they're also done the book, but they haven't actually been able to implement it during the same time. And then they apologize like, I'm sorry. Like it's funny that they have to sort of
of course they don't, but yeah, everybody, they do. Yeah. I went to South by Southwest one year, and everyone that met me said, oh, you're Jeffrey Zelman. I'm sorry, my site doesn't validate.
Exactly. So I think I did that same thing, and you, I think you emailed me back like, you know, great job, keep reaching for the stars or something like that.
That's right.
So listen, I want to change subject here, because there's something okay. that's very intriguing to me anytime that I talk to somebody like Jason. Now, Jason, when you and I met, and I'm trying to remember actually like how and when, and I feel like maybe it predated the project that we were talking about, but I can't recall. But if I remember right, you were working for full time. You were a full time employee for a company, and you were like the only designer in there, right? And am I remembering that right?
No, not entirely. I bounced around at a few agencies when I got out of school. I worked at one for a couple of years, and another after that for a few more years. But at each place, there was a dedicated design team, so I was just one of the designers or an art director.
Okay,
you know.
And you know, you've come a long way. You worked independently. You've worked with Jeffrey, and then recently you made a move to strike out on your own again. And mm-hmm. I wanted to hear about that. What inspired you to make that change? And also, you know, what have you found it to be like? Because when you did that, you know, I think a day or two after is when the recession happened. So I'm curious right. to hear, you know, about the timing of that. I mean, maybe you can talk about that experience.
It's funny. Jeffrey would probably have the same exact thing to say, because I knew he started HappyCog basically right after the dot-com burst.
Right.
I found it to be amazing. And I mean, the reason that I wanted to do something else is I think for a long time, I kind of kept telling myself that I was working towards just having one job and getting like one paycheck every week, and how relaxing that might be, because it would be easier to manage and all of my time goes towards one thing. But as I'm sure you probably know, like from all the stuff that Jeffrey read out at the beginning, I wear a lot of different hats on any given day, on any given week. And I guess at some point I just started to embrace that and realize that variety is what really makes me feel inspired and makes me want to, you know, jump out of bed and start doing stuff every day. So that was one of the biggest reasons. And if you look at all the different things that I get involved in, I just try to do something, you know, that's different than the last thing that I did, whether it's a book or a website or, you know, just being involved in my local community through AIGA. There are lots of different avenues for creativity.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think for whatever reason, some people have a hard time coming up with their own creative project or coming up with a group creative project. Maybe address, what do you do if you really want to expand? You don't want to just be stuck at your job, because, you know, for whatever, your job's paying the bills, it's very nice, but let's say you're not getting to do your best work at your job and you want to give mm-hmm. something back to the community and you want to create something, but you don't know what to create. Where do you go for inspiration, or how do you reach out to other people and find a project to work on? Maybe it's a bad question for you, because maybe you never lack inspiration. I don't know.
Oh, no. I mean, inspiration is a is a crazy roller coaster ride with me. I think I've said something before, like my creative process is all about, you know, getting excited, then like being depressed and thinking it sucks, and then sort of coming back up again and you know, being excited again. It's sort of this ongoing struggle of self-doubt and feeling like what you're doing is insufficient for what you want to achieve. But as far as like figuring out how to broaden what you're doing, at least for me, I've always looked at, it's simple, but like just looking at reading, and also like almost everywhere in the world, you can take classes at a school of some sort, you know, and it might be something that sort of parallels what you already do, or something that you might want to get interested in down the road. I took a bunch of letterpress courses when I was in Philadelphia, or photography courses. There's so much out there that you can do that, you know, can give back to the work that you do already on the web.
We'd like to say thanks to Rackspace.com for sponsoring this episode as well. We all hate waiting. Waiting is for chumps. I'm serious. Think about it. So why wait on your images, your videos, your JavaScript, CSS to download from traditional origin locations? Instead, use a CDN. It's 2011. You know, wake up. It's time. Rackspace has partnered with Akamai, you've heard of them, and their global CDN to make waiting forever for file downloads a thing of the past. So if you're a web developer, a designer, and the performance of your site actually matters to you, you can check out Rackspace Cloud Files. Love this stuff. The Akamai CDN is bundled in at no additional charge, so you can finally stop waiting. Check them out at rackspace.com/cloud, and everything will be so much faster. Support for 5x5 is also provided by Pocket Casts. This is something new. You got to check this out. It allows you to subscribe to your favorite podcasts and download them and stream them over Wi-Fi or 3G on your iOS or Android device. Created by podcast enthusiasts and 5x5 fans, visit pocketcasts.com to find out more.
Usability expert Dana Chisnell joined Jeffrey and Dan on episode 33 of The Big Web Show.
It's my subjective impression that there are more men in design and more women in user experience. I could be totally smoking crack. I don't know. But is that your impression as well? And if so, what do you think accounts for it?
No, I don't think that's necessarily true. Maybe you just meet a lot of guys who are in design. I meet a lot of women who are in design, and so
I'd like to meet a lot of women who are in design.
Well, call. We can talk about that later.
Right.
But I do believe that there are things that women are better at and men are better at. Would I be able to separate those things out in user experience design? No, probably not. But I think there are pockets of UX that are populated with more women or more men. And I think that, from my experience, is about where those people came from and sort of where the practice is now. So, like, a lot of people who do usability testing as their main thing came from other disciplines like technical communication. And a lot of technical communicators are women because you're writers. Now, that wasn't always true. Before the advent of cheap personal computers, technical writers were guys because they came out of the military. So I think it's just, from my perspective, cyclical and maybe about perception more than anything else.
It's about perception, but also about history and history of technology, just as you've just said. That was kind of what I was wondering about, and I think that was a brilliant answer. Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
I remember when I was young and technical writers were men. I totally remember pipe smoking, scotch drinking men. Like,
those were the days.
Yeah. Well, who remembers? Who remembers, really?
So, Dana, if people would like to follow you or learn more about you, we have your Twitter name up there, DANACHIS on Twitter. But where are some other places people can go to?
Danakis. Danakis.
Yeah. I like that pronunciation.
I like that.
What do you say, Dana Chiz? When you tell me I'm Dana Chiz.
Yeah.
For the final segment in this episode of The Big Web Show, Drupal expert Jen Simmons joins Dan and Jeffrey. This is from episode 35 of the program.
So, Jen, in every space, there are competitors. And who's the competitor for Drupal then? Is it Rails and Django? Is it WordPress? Is it Expression Engine? And this is the kind of thing that when you suggest using a platform to a client, and just like you and Jeffrey, I spent many years doing consulting and development work, you've got to often justify your choice of a platform to your potential client. Who are the competitors in this space, and what are some of the things that make Drupal stand out that are really, really great selling points, and maybe in a way sell some of the listeners on it? I mean, why should we consider this when there are other avenues to go down, and why would our client be happy with this choice?
I think everything you mentioned is a competitor. People talk a lot about WordPress and Drupal or Joomla and Drupal, but I think Rails and Ruby on Rails and .NET and other sorts of frameworks are frequently, I think it depends on what you're doing, what your project is. The reason I like Drupal and the reason I got excited about it as a designer, because I still consider myself a designer more than a developer, is I could build much more complicated websites without going out and learning, how to create my own content management system from scratch or learn some of these frameworks. Installing it, clicking buttons, downloading plugins, which are called modules, and turning them on, and click, 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 click. You can click together a really sophisticated website without a whole lot of time. It's just faster than doing something like, opening up a PHP document and just hand coding an entire CMS. Sure. And that was really attractive to me. Like, what do you mean? I can build a site like Flickr? I can build a site like, I can build one of these sites where people can log in and do things? Like, I could sell that to my client instead of just building a whole bunch of more, brochure websites or blogs, which is what I was doing before Drupal.
Are you able to customize the user experience in those? The way we work a lot of times, we first figure out what the goals are, then we sit, we create a user experience architecture, and then, we design how that looks and what all the screens are, and then the last thing we do is develop. But here it's the exact reverse of that, where someone's figured out a lot of stuff, but is it necessarily working the way you might design it from scratch?
Right. You can do anything you want with Drupal, actually. You can actually make anything you want out of it. There are some things that Drupal likes to do better than others, and there's some ways you can kind of lean into letting Drupal be Drupal. And, much like some of these other systems like WordPress, there's just certain ways that the content's going to land on the page. And if you don't fight it, you're going to be better off. But it's really...
Has it changed the way you... Has that... I hear what you're saying with that. Your music might change if you recorded with all the Daptones, right? They only record, and their producer only records with like equipment from the 1960s, like rotary dials instead of faders and, tube amps and everything. And it changes the way they make music. It changes the kind of songs they write.
Yeah.
Does that same thing happen with you as an experienced designer, where you're so familiar with the platform that you think, this is how a member page should look and should work. This is how, this is how much we should ask of a potential user before they become a member. This is how we should do privacy, all these things. Does the tool change your thinking and evolve your thinking?
I think it does some. I also think that the web and the way the web is right now probably does more. Because so many clients come in the door and they kind of already have this idea of what they want, that they want this from Facebook and this from Twitter and this from this website. kind of Frankenstein together into their own. And, you know, ideally as a designer, you're able to go in and say, okay, well, let's that's great. Let's back up a minute. Let's talk about why your website exists and who your users are and see if we can't, you know, figure out what's best for your users rather than, you know, Flickr's users or
right.
Facebook's users. And yeah, I think Drupal, you know, there's definitely ways that Drupal kind of interjects in there and goes, hey, I'd like to do it this way. But
as a freelancer, right? You're a freelancer.
Actually, I work for a company. I started working for a company called Palantir.net. They're in Chicago.
Okay.
I do web development and web design and use Drupal a lot for our projects.
So you not having that conversation with clients now, where the client comes in and wants to Frankenstein this and that, or do you fly out to Chicago and meet with the clients?
I do, yeah. I will. You know, I'm still new there, but yeah, I will be doing some of that or working with teams where other people are doing that and talking to clients.
I like you and I'm interested in whether you're employed or not, but the reason I asked the question was really because it sounds like and you're not a freelancer anymore, but it sounds like this would be an ideal tool for the people in our audience who are listening who maybe work out of their apartment or in a shared, you know, a co-working space, and they're competing for, you know, bigger jobs. They're competing against agencies and, you know, but they don't have a whole team of IAs to sit with them. They don't have a whole, you know, they can't, but the client still wants what all clients want. And it's a good tool for the person to be able to say, oh, sure, we can do that. You need a member page? Sure, we could do that. Yep. A wiki for your users? Yeah, that's not a problem. It allows you to be bigger because in a way, you've got that whole Drupal community doing some of the work for you. It's like, and you're putting work back into it as well. So, you know, it's an ecosystem. It's fair. I mean, that's a very impressive selling proposition to me for a very small team or a freelancer, I think, which is, you know, I'm not that anymore, but that's where my heart is. That's how I started my company. And I did that for a long time, you know, and it's tough. It's tough to when you have to be the project manager, the user experience designer, the graphic designer, the coder, everything.
Yeah.
What tools? So you've already talked about. You said there are. Can you recommend some videos or books or anything that anyone who's interested in this? Because we're not going to just talk about Drupal, but while we are there things people could, you know, to get over that steep learning curve? Is there some introductory text or what do you recommend?
Yeah, if you go to Drupal.org, there's a whole section on a whole list of all the books that are out right now for Drupal, which is always a great way to start if that works for you to learn things. Lullabot has a video series. You can buy videos one at a time, or you can, they have a subscription service now. You can just get access to all their videos for a fee per month. The DrupalCon conference in March in Chicago, the early bird registration ends tomorrow, on the 21st. I think the early bird price is $350 and then it will go up to $400. And there's a lot of great people who are going to be there, speaking. Jared Spool, Clay Shirky, Mark Bolton, Jeremy Keith. It's a lot about Drupal. It's also, you know, about web design development in general.
We talked about this yesterday, but they reached out to me, but I just felt since I didn't use the platform that I shouldn't speak there. But that, you think that was stupid?
You should come speak. Yeah, it'd be great. I think it'd be great to have you come for sure.
I just imagine people going, but how does that apply to Drupal? Or but in a Drupal such and such module, and I don't really know, sir.
It's funny, people, you know, and I've become one of them. People are very passionate about Drupal, and I think it happens because it is one of these places on the web where people are doing it just for the sake of doing it. They love the work they're doing. They love code and having pure code. They love creating tools and giving them away to people for free. And you end up just getting really passionate about, because I went from someone who could build this certain kind of website to someone who could build a way more sophisticated website in almost the same amount of time, And clients want that. You said it really well earlier. Like, clients come and they want Facebook and they want to spend $10,000 to get it. And you're like, well, do you know how much money Facebook spent building Facebook? Like, it was more than $10,000. But with some of these tools that Drupal provides, you actually can. You can go ahead and start building out a lot of those types of websites for people.
Thanks again so much for tuning into this special show. I really hope you liked it. I want to say a special thanks to Jim, my super engineer of awesomeness, who spent a lot of time putting this thing together and making sure it was great. So thanks to Jim for doing this. Please go to 5x5.tv and check out the other shows that we have there. I do a show called The Daily Edition, which I do every day, 5 days a week. There's also Hypercritical, a show with John Siracusa, Back to Work with Merlin Mann, and a handful of other new shows that are just premiering. So we'd love for you to go check those out at 5x5.tv. Thanks again very much to our new sponsor, FreshBooks.com, Rackspace.com, and all of you guys for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please rate it in iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find out about it. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. See you again next week.